Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for those of you who don't already know me, I'm the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of the book Integral Life Practice, which I co-authored with Ken Wilber. I convened this series of deep conversations to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture because I felt that we have a hard time talking about the elephant in the living room, which in a way is how our growth as individuals and the growth of our relationship to one another can help us rise to the challenges of our world crises, to find the inner resources and the capacity to cooperate that can allow us to make a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've held a series of varied and very different, enlivening, profound conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And they're all available for you to listen to for free. They're MP3 downloads. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're available for download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, I'm honored and delighted to be joined by Hamid Ali, who writes under the name A.H. Almas, to continue that discussion in a conversation that we're titling Responsive Enlightenment. And the way this will work is that I'll introduce Hamid and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and we'll finish up in probably a little over 90 minutes. Hamid Ali was born in Kuwait in 1944, and at the age of 18, he moved to the United States to study at the University of California in Berkeley. And while he was there working on his PhD in physics, he reached a turning point in his life and destiny that led him more and more into inquiring into the psychological and spiritual aspects of human nature. His interest in the depth and truth of the human experience and human nature and the true nature of reality resulted not only in him being a student of these things, but gradually an original thinker and teacher and creator of the Diamond Approach, which is a path of investigation of reality and transformational work on one's own self that's designed to lead to human maturity and liberation. So he offers that work through the Ridwan School, and he's the author of many excellent books, The Elixir of Enlightenment, Essence, The Diamond Approach to Inner Realization, the Diamond Mind series, the Diamond Heart series, and the Diamond Body series, among many others. The Pearl Beyond Price is one excellent book, several really wonderful books on the Enneagram, including Facets of Unity. His personal website is ahalmas.com, and you can find out more about the Ridwan School at Ridwan, RIDHWAN.org. So, welcome, Hamid. I'm really grateful that you've joined us here today, and I'm really happy to have you with us.
Thanks, Terry. I'm glad to be here to participate, see what I can contribute.
Wonderful. Well, I think maybe the beginning point will simply be to ask you why you chose this title and what it is you mean by responsive enlightenment.
Because enlightenment being recognizing that we are the spiritual nature that we are, and that's what enlightenment means, to realize that, to be that, instead of being simply the self or the ego individual that take ourselves to be, we are an infinity, a mystery that we call true nature or spiritual nature. And being that, our action becomes the responsiveness of that truth. So enlightenment is simply being the spiritual nature. And spiritual nature is not a static truth. It is a living, alive intelligence that is responsive and responds to the situations at hand, and responds with its own qualities and its own ways of expressing itself, its own ways of expressing and revealing itself as the truth, depending on the situation, depending on the people, depending on the times. So it's the same thing with an individual human being who's realized. Human being who's realized is not an automaton. A realized human being responds to situation, and the response is always intelligent and appropriate to the situation. So it's not like the realized person is thinking about things and thinking about their realization and then from there decide what to do. No. The realization means that the responsiveness happens naturally and spontaneously comes from that purity, that lovingness, that goodness that has the well-being of all beings in its heart. So that's what I mean by being responsive, enlightenment. I wanted to make sure that enlightenment is not one thing, not one monolithic kind of state one is in. It's the state itself that actually changes depending on the situation. So its responsiveness is not only responds with one action, one communication, or one expression, but also responds by changing its form, transforming its state of being to qualities and forms and dimensions that actually correspond to what is happening. And its responsiveness is beyond the human intelligence. We as individual cannot sort of compute fast enough or know, have enough knowledge and wisdom to know what's the best way to respond. But our spiritual true nature automatically and naturally and spontaneously and organically simply responds. And sometimes the mind gets it, catches on, so in hindsight, oh, that's why we did such and such. So that's really the meaning, reason why I called it responsive enlightenment, to highlight the fact that enlightenment is not one condition one arrives at, but it is a dynamic, living reality that is responding to particular situations in our lives.
Well, that's beautiful. It's interesting. You know, the very last dialogue that I held was with Arjuna Arda, and it was titled "Cancel Your Subscription to Enlightenment." Arjuna is a very iconoclastic fellow and pretty humorous, and he was kind of saying that this idea of an end state that is the resolution of all your problems, that is a radical transition, that everything should be focused on that enlightenment, is a myth that people have been burdened by. You seem to be describing something that's very dynamic and free, but you still use the word enlightenment. So to some people that connotes a, you know, like that up until a certain point people are unenlightened and then they become enlightened and there's a really significant shift. Is that how you're using the word, or do you mean it in a different way?
I actually usually use the word realization, but the word realization needs explanation, and so I use enlightenment because that's the word that people are used to. It's what's in circulation, and definitely means there's something we need to learn. We need to become authentic, become our true self, our true spiritual nature. That's what enlightenment and realization mean. Otherwise, everybody, of course, is responding, and everybody, most people are responding from their egoistic, self-centered self. So there is a learning, a maturing process, and there's an awakening that happens in it, a discovery, there is a realization of that discovery, an actualization of it, and developing that a transformation of the consciousness and the mind that makes the individual consciousness and mind a vehicle for this realization to express itself. So it's an involved process. It's not one event. although there are many events in it that we could call the event of enlightenment or awakening. So I agree that there isn't one final state. You know, although we can find many states that many people think of as final in the sense they are free and they are, they have a lot, they are true about reality. But I think reality is more mysterious than trying to capture it in a snapshot in one condition. But it is definitely a state of purity, a state of perfection or a state of goodness. It has heart, mind, everything in it, implicit in it. But definitely, by enlightenment, I mean there is a condition of awakening and realization. We're not in the ordinary self-centered condition. Otherwise, we'll just keep making more messes.
Yeah. I think I'd like to pursue this a little more because some of our listeners, I think, were quite taken with some of the things that Arjuna said. He was kind of trying to just orient people to this present moment, to the potential for authenticity and our living reality right now, and kind of trying to disabuse people of the sense that there's somewhere else they need to get to and that there's a not-yetness, to the idea I'm not enlightened now, I need to be enlightened later. But there was also, maybe you might count, I'm not sure, but I'm perhaps intuiting from the other things you've just said, that you might counter that by saying, yes, and on the other hand, there really is a matter of growth, and that we do profit and benefit from paying attention to the potentials for authenticity and purity, and have the humility to recognize that although this may not all be about a single event and one radical toggle switch between unenlightened and enlightened, there is a profound matter of becoming more and more translucent and transparent to being, and deserves maybe it's an emphasis of the gradual path rather than only the sudden path, perhaps. I'm not sure if that's language you'd use. How would you reflect on this issue?
I think it's partly has to do the difference between method and realization. The method I use is to definitely be where we are and be as authentic as we are in the moment. Being in the moment is the way to practice. You cannot practice about thinking about the past or trying to get someplace in the future. So the work, the method which really embodies the realization is that where we are in the moment is reality. It's always reality. However, at the same time, while we're saying that, being in the moment, most people are not able to be in the moment. Most people are living in the past or thinking of the future or controlled by the past. So to be in the moment is by itself a realization. It's not a certain easy, simple thing. Although it can start with simply recognizing what we're really feeling, what's really happening with us in the moment, and that is fine. That's the beginning. So, yes, I agree with the thing about being in the moment. But being in the moment means different thing and different condition and different realization. It could be seen from the ordinary condition, the ego condition, being in the moment, being just whatever you feel and you express whatever you feel. Being in the moment means recognizing that you are not really in the moment. You are, your mind and your consciousness is trapped somewhere else, and you're not able to be in the moment. So being in the moment will take practice, will take some kind of awakening and maturing. And then being in the moment and various conditions of realization also mean different things. Being in the moment means being in the now, the eternal now. Being in the moment being beyond time. Being in the moment being in all moments. So to say being in the moment is a whole thing. It means many things, and depending on where the person is. But generally speaking, in all of them, the question is, being in the moment is really all what we got. because the moment is what we got. That's the reality. And it is always the express. See, the way I look at it is being in the moment is always reality, but reality can manifest itself in a distorted way or can manifest itself in a more real, pure, and distorted way. And all of them are happening in the moment. And so spiritual work or spiritual practice is learning how to be in the moment in a way that expresses the purity of reality, not its distortions.
So I'm really loving this. For those who listen to each of these broadcasts exactly as they happen, I'm sure that some of our listeners are appreciating the kind of irony here, because in a way, I just had a conversation with someone who was kind of trying to deconstruct anything I said and kind of go radical in what I call the sudden school, just always, you know, it's only right here in the moment. There's nothing between you and realization except your humanity. The foibled condition of the body mind is not a problem. It doesn't even need to be perfected. The truth of being is always available. And you're emphasizing the other side of this in a way that I think is attentive to the sudden school, but pointing to the importance of regular practice, the importance of humble application to the process through which that sudden purity, that always already freedom, can be actually known and realized, and the maybe the humble application of oneself to that again and again in many moments over time.
I agree with you, Terry. Humility is very important here. It is true that reality and purity is always present, always available. However, even when we have that, when we experience that, that doesn't mean we're able to express it or communicate it, because that requires the vehicle of communication, which is the human body and mind, the human consciousness. And these need to be worked through, need to be clarified, need to be transformed. And they don't get transformed simply through sudden awakening. Even the schools that of sudden awakening, like Zen, for instance, they have stages. They have the stages of awakening or realization, then they have the stage of actualization, which means how to put what you have learned into actual practice in life. So even the school of sudden realization recognize there is a period where you have to hone in the instrument of expression of living. Sudden realization, even though it is a reality, I mean, the truth of sudden realization is present all the time, and even if we recognize it, does not give us the capacity to be able to express it fully without further transformation. It might happen, but that's very rare. Out of 1 out of 10 million who could realize that can happen. So I think we need to be humble enough to recognize that we'll still have stuff to work through to clear our instruments. And that's an important part of the practice, definitely. And it's also the fun part of the practice, is how we discover more things about reality. By learning to express our realization, we find out that realization itself changes and transforms, doesn't stay the same. Realization sitting in a zafu and realization as you walk and talk are two different things. You see, realization, that's what I mean, enlightenment responds, meaning the state of condition that we have awakened to, the purity, transforms depending on what we are responding to. So, and it's a continual process of discovery. So it's not like it's just a problem we have to get through. It is part of the journey, part of the process of realization and discovery, because the enlightened life is a continual life of discovery. It's not like you discover something, you sit in it forever, and that's it. If it is like that, it's very boring after a while.
Well, this is certainly a big part of my own teaching, the profound, infinite depth of being is paradoxically present in the simplest, emptiest, present moment, that the present moment is infinitely deep, that the nature of reality is infinitely deep and profound and full of power and blessing and amazement, and that sense of openness to that possibility, the beginner's mind that lets me be innocent enough to open more and more and more, that requires cultivation.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to talk about living in the moment, but usually people who are already able to do it talk about it that way.
So a lot of what you're...
Most people can't be in the moment, it's as simple as that. I mean, you could just say somebody being in the moment expressed themselves, how about that person feeling hateful and want to kill somebody? What does it mean to live in the moment? Is living in the moment mean going ahead and killing somebody?
Well, clearly, that person,
that's not what's meant by being in the moment.
Yeah. And so your work really concentrates on the skillful means of the school through which people actually engage the gradual process of refinement, purification, and transformation through which they can be in the moment.
Well, yeah, there are two sides of it. There is the sudden part of awakening to reality, and there is the more progressive part, which is the clarification and transformation of the vehicle through which it becomes expressed. And this, in our work, in my school, there are two threads that go hand in hand, because the sudden awakening is not only one kind of sudden awakening, not one. There are many kinds that happen at different times. And it interacts with the more the vehicle itself, the consciousness, is transformed and clarified from its delusions and illusions and ideas, other ways of awakening can become possible, which in turn, you know, help the consciousness to keep clarifying and becoming a more transparent instrument for the truth.
And one of the things that you've especially emphasized in your school, well, I'm not a deep student of your work, but I'm very aware of the work you've done with inquiry and dialogue, and also the work you've done with the Enneagram and self-understanding and typology. I'm curious if you'd elaborate on those and how those relate to us becoming a different kind of person who's capable of a different kind of action and behavior in the world. Because obviously I do want to circle back around to this idea that our realization ultimately needs to find an expression that allows us to be different kinds of people and to create a different kind of culture.
Right. My idea of realization is not you don't get you realize and check out. Many people think realization is enlightened. You get enlightened to leave the world. For me, realization is to fulfill the world, to fulfill life in the world, and to help other people find their destiny and fulfillment in the world. Inquiry is very important. Inquiry is the primary approach I use to experience, just like some people use prayers or meditation or all that. My method is inquiry, which is really inquiring into what is happening in the moment in my perception experience, meaning recognizing it, being with it intimately as possible, feeling it, knowing it, but being curious about it, not assuming it. I know it, I understand it, not assuming I see everything about it, but being open that there is a lot there that I don't see, I don't understand. It has meaning and depth and facets I don't recognize. So the inquiry is a questioning of what is happening in the moment, not a questioning in the sense of suspicion or questioning wanting to change it, but as a curiosity, a love of finding out what is really happening. Why am I this way? What makes me feel this way? Why is this condition is happening? And by this kind of inquiry and questioning, the present moment reveals further dimensions of itself, other possibilities of itself. And that can bring up both the transformation and the awakening to different degrees of true nature. So the inquiry is the primary practice that each individual can do on their own. They could do it with their friends. And of course, I also have a dialectic application of the inquiry where two people can do it in their relationship, where the interactive mode itself becomes part of the inquiry, and that becomes a looping kind of energetic, closing an energetic loop, so that the energies of two people can highlight each other's, so they can help each other inquire into what is happening. And that way they have simultaneous mutual discoveries of themselves, of each other, their relationship, of the reality they live in, and how to interact in a way. So that can, of course, brings up difficulties, issues, and history of the relationship, which can also need to be addressed and inquired into, but not as a problem, but as part of the elements of the present moment. And as we inquire in those elements of the present moment, they simply usually open up. The present moment is a presentation of reality. Reality is always continually opening up further and further and revealing further and further. And inquiry is an invitation for this opening, for this revelation. Because we're interested, we love to know what reality wants to say, wants to do, how it wants to present itself.
Then the quality of attention and curiosity and openness and expectancy, that itself is something that grows through the inquiry, that the capacity to inquire itself is deepened.
I agree with you. This inquiry develops through the inquiry. And in our school, of course, we give courses. We have retreats and all of that, where we specifically inquire sometime into some of the particulars of those capacities. Like we do inquiries and exploration of curiosity. What's that about? What's limiting it? How come I'm not curious? How come my curiosity is only oriented in one way or another? Why isn't open-ended? We also do inquiries into the loving the truth itself. Do we care about the truth? What do we feel the truth is? Is it something static? Is it something that is dynamic? We inquire into our clarity, into our intelligence, into our concentration, our focus. All these becomes objects we sometimes spend time specifically focusing on each one of them, inquiring into them, so that they begin to present themselves, and that way reality liberate its dynamism to express those qualities that are necessary for inquiry. You see, from the perspective of the human being, the individual, we are inquiring. From the perspective of reality, reality is simply revealing its secrets, its possibilities. There are two ways of saying the same thing.
Beautiful. I want to come back to this deep level of attention that we're bringing to the actual process of growth and awakening and personal, you might say, unfolding. But I do want to bring in this more objective dimension of things, the sense that I and many people have that the crises of our time have some unique qualities, that we are aware of ourselves as evolution in a way that's unprecedented, that we are reaching some critical breakdown points in terms of our interconnected economy and world system, that the potential for us to begin to evolve consciously is upon us in a new way, and that the necessity of us cooperating in a whole new way is upon us in a way that's unprecedented. I'm not sure you agree with all of that, but all of us do care, and I know you join me in this, at least, in the intention and hope that we can uplift the human condition by the way we engage with one another, that we can become a somewhat more enlightened culture, at least a subculture within our larger culture, and that we can be a part of something healthy in the fabric of humanity that can be the healing and evolution and development of more skillful responses amidst the challenges that human beings are facing. How do you see the processes of awakening and unfoldment and deepening and authenticity and purity that you've just been talking about? How does that enable us to show up in the world as caring healers and leaders of something new and healthy?
Well, that's why I termed, I said, a responsive enlightenment, in the sense that I'm not just enlightened and I'm just living free. A responsive means I'm responding to the situation that I find myself in. And the situation I find myself in is what you described, the culture and the world we live in. It has its specifics. You know, at other times it has a different specific, but now it has certain specifics which are particularly difficult for many people. So the enlightenment will have to respond to that. So what action I take, how I take the action, will have to take that into consideration. So I'm ceaselessly working with many individuals, 1,000 individuals, so that they realize themselves and able to be themselves in such a way that they can respond to their reality in a way that is more effective, more healing, and that way I'm sort of helping spread that consciousness where more people are able to actually deal with the world from their vantage point. Each person has their own vantage point. They have their vocation, they have the job, they have the situation, and they can do certain things that other people can't do. So if they are more awakened and they have the true love and caring for humanity and compassion in their heart, how they will conduct themselves will not just be simply making a living and getting by. They will become aware of what's happening around them, and they will naturally respond to the situation to do what they can to help with those situations. So, I mean, it is inherent to actually true enlightenment, responsive enlightenment, is that it is aware of what it wants to be aware of what's going on, and to find out what to do about it from an enlightened perspective, meaning not from a place that is not self-centered, not selfish. I'm not here to just protect myself, make sure that my money is safe, make sure I'm safe in this world, but to see that the whole world is a unity, is one unified fabric of reality. We're all in it together. And, you know, what is good for me is going to be good for the other. What's bad for me is going to be bad for the other. In fact, that is inherent to enlightenment anyway. But, you know, I know many people who are into realization, they go off by themselves and they just live a quiet life. And in our work, that's possible. That's a choice the individual make. But I leave it to all the individual themselves, what they do with their life. So in our school, we're not an activist school. We don't say, okay, let's get together, get a meeting, and let's do this about society. It's more like everybody is empowered to do what they can do in their situation. So some people in the group have their groups and committees and things that they do, and they join various organizations in the world to help one way or another. So, but the more they are in touch with themselves, the more they are really in the moment from their true self, from their purity, both their compassion and love is more present and not as afraid or as self-centered. At the same time, they're more intelligent, more clear about what can be done, what need to be done, what can be done, what are the limitations of the situation, with a natural also part of realization is there is a natural inner deep security and safety that is beyond the particulars. You know, that's part of being realized. At the depth, we know we are indestructible. We are at peace. And we are beyond the particular time and space. But this inner core of being beyond time and space does care for what happens in time and space, and that's its responsiveness. It's love and caring and effective functioning. Part of the work I do is development of the instrument. Part of development of the instrument is developing the individual consciousness so that the individual becomes a real human being, a complete human being. Means a real human being means a human being who integrates the inner world with the outer world, where one has a foot in the inner world and a foot in the outer world, straddles the two worlds and integrates them, bring them to one. So that way the inner realization and living in life are not separate. In fact, for me, what I've been focusing on for years now in my school is how to live one realization. How to live one realization means live it in the world, in our particular situation, in our society, in our culture, in the world as a whole. And living it means expressing all the riches of reality that we have inside, how to bring them out. And, of course, the more, and we'll see the necessities of the situation, the demands of the situation. And obviously, these days, situation has different demands and bigger necessities will impel us in various ways, depending where we are in our life, to take certain actions, write books, engage in conferences, get together with people. You know, some people are activists and some people are more like teachers, and everybody's different that way. So the teaching doesn't determine how the person responds to the world, but it gives them both the reality and the wherewithal of how to respond in whatever way they deem is their destiny, their place in the world.
Beautiful. Very, very resonant with what I teach. In integral spiritual practice, I sometimes talk about spheres of practice that I practice in relation to bodily health and fitness and to my emotional life. I have spiritual practices. There's practices that engage my mind. There are practices that have to do with my relationships, my intimate relationships, raising children, caring for parents. But then there's also a civic sphere. There's my sphere as a citizen of my community and of my nation and my world. And I look upon that as a dimension in which practice is important too. If all the most conscious people withdraw from the public sphere, we leave it in the hands of more reactive and less awake people, and it's important for us to be showing up there too. Does that resonate for you? Do you see that or teach that as a dimension of practice?
It resonates with me in a certain way, Terry, which is that you cannot force somebody to become spiritual. You know, spirituality and spiritual search or spiritual activation is something that comes from the heart. We can inspire people, you know, and can invite them to participate in a spiritual view of reality, but we cannot really force it upon them. You know, it has to come from within them. So I do what I can to inspire and to bring the word and to, you know, show the possibilities so that more people become involved that way. And if people in the civic sphere become involved, it's great. Our society is very complex, however, where most of the people who are in position of power are not interested in spiritual work. They are too enamored with the power and the greed of their position. So how to bring in spirituality to those areas is a challenge, I think. Not going to be easy. Doesn't mean, you know, some of us won't undertake it, but I'm saying it's going to be a challenge.
Do you, you know, one of the conversations, I've had a lot of conversations here, Hamid, as you know, and some of the people I've spoken with have simply, they've stuck radically with the principle that to the degree that our consciousness is false, to the degree that we're confused and unenlightened, the degree that our hearts are not open, to the degree that we're not living as love, there's really nothing more important than simply becoming true, waking up, relaxing, forgiving ourselves, coming into sanity, coming into a place where we can be here, present as awake consciousness, as love, and be love now, as Ram Dass put it. But then there have been other people who have said that love is action, and that in this time, our spirituality does need to become a more dynamic force in our larger world, and that sense of that a new kind of urgency can emerge once one has freed oneself up from too many of these kind of reactive motives, anxious, anxiety-based motives, even anxiety-based motives that might be about making the world a better place. But when you wake up from that, a new kind of urgency and obligation appear, one that leaves us feeling freed up from egoic motives and freed up from simply the sense of being relieved of those motives, and then opened into a higher sense of service and necessity and urgency that is that feels liberated and enlivening, and that as we really awaken into that in this moment in time, there's a potential for us to come together as allies of the well-being of the planet, the well-being of this process of evolution, that we can be activists in a different sense, and that that's really important, and that we can't have a conversation that's only about the personal emergence from egoic suffering, that it needs to link into that higher potential for enlightened service. What do you think of that?
I think this has been an age-old question for a long time. Spiritual people have always been engaged with this, questioning this. What can we do about the rest of society? What can we do so that the society as a whole can function more optimally and more? Remember all the time from Plato, his attempts at influencing the powers to be and developing his academy and trying to teach the kids of the people in power so that they become more enlightened rulers. So that's an attempt has always been made, and it is natural for people who realize to want to do that. And the thing about it, however, is we cannot expect everybody who's realized to do that, because everybody got their destiny. And part of the realization, part of the enlightenment, is each person finds what their destiny is, what their contribution to the world is. It can be solo, you go on a solo and do something, or it can be you do a collective action and participate in some kind of civic, even political or social. So it's different for different people. I wouldn't dictate it to anybody, because part of the realization is recognizing the uniqueness of each one of us and how reality is wanting to manifest itself in a specific, unique way that is different for each people, and we all need to discover it. Also, many of us might find that we wanted to take collective action or do something about society as a whole. The thing, however, is also spiritual realization has inherent in it the attitude of service. When I say to express realization, to our instrument to be clarified and developed, so express realization, this expression is mostly service. That's what when somebody's realized what's left in their life is but basically serving their fellow human beings, serving life, serving the larger whole, and whichever way we can do it. So you're thinking about it in a certain way, which I think is great, and I'm sure many people are involved in it that way, and I think the more people involved in it, the better. But it is not something that can be made into an ideology, because everybody is really, their destiny is different from what I see. That's when I work with people, I try to find their uniqueness and try to help them come to their uniqueness and find out what is, how does their true nature wants to manifest through them? Is it going to manifest through them by becoming a politician and trying to change this political system? Or is it for them to become a better doctor, a better scientist? Or is it to go and engage in activist? Everybody is different. And I help people to, try to help people to come to that, to find out what is it that is really true for them.
Well, that's beautiful. And therefore, what you're saying is that for many of us, it may mean coming together in some cooperative way, but you wouldn't want to lay that as an imperative on everyone because you want to respect the unique path of each individual. However, every individual would serve, even if they wouldn't all serve in the same way.
All individuals, any realized individual will naturally serve. They can't help it but serve. True nature is completely generous and giving and sensitive and compassionate and tend to be aware of the situation. And the more realized we are, because there are very kinds and degrees of realization, the more we're aware of our situation, especially if our realization is not sectarian. Many people have realizations that are from one teaching or another, and so become sectarians, and we really want the good of our teaching, of our sect. But if our realization is more within the, it's a contemporary kind, which is free from that sectarian thing, it's just the truth itself, whatever it is, then we're aware of what's happening in the situation, and we will do what we can. Different people can do different things. They have different capacities. They have different background. They have different developments, and they can do different. One person can do sometimes a lot more than 1,000 people can do, depending on their area of capacity, you see. So that's why I won't lay it on everybody to do it that way, but I imagine, I know there are many people who are doing it, who are congregating and doing it, and it's great. It's one of the it's one of our sort of contemporary manifestations that many spiritual people feel they need to collect together and do things together, and that is one thing that's happening, and obviously it's a good thing. So one thing, Terry, I want to say is that our times are really interesting time, because there is some kind of awakening that is happening in the world as a whole, some kind of way, because situations are difficult, there are challenges to the human race, and so there are responses to it, and some of the responses are more of the spiritual, awakened, free, liberated way of responding to it, but a large part of the response to the world is also more of a narrowing down and a fundamentalist way of looking at things. And if you look around you in the world, the fundamentalist, narrowing down, more rigid way of trying to respond to the crisis of the world is actually more of the majority than the liberal and the more free-spirited people who want to do things. Although we have more spirited people who want to do things together, but if we look at the world and the demography of the whole world and what's really happening, it's not clear what's going to happen, because there are powerful forces there that are, they're more into violence or into making their view of reality be the real thing. We know what God is, and this is God's, we know it in our society here. Look what's happening in our society. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do what we can do. I think we could always continue doing our service. So one way of looking at it, for me, Terry, is I don't have, I think, an iota of a messianic tendency. I have no messianic tendencies, meaning saving the world. I don't think I'm going to be able to save the world, and I don't know if the world need to be saving. But there are always situations that requires help, requires need, and we do have situations that is more dire than usual, you know, and which brings actual situations for or opportunities for many people to serve, opportunities that weren't present before.
And that kind of ties into one of the themes of the series here, which is the question, how can our spiritual practices evolve in our current time? Certainly our world has been changing very rapidly just in the time you've had your school open.
Yeah.
Are there ways in which this eternal, unchanging, profound, ancient matter of awakening still is appropriately engaged in new ways? Are there ways that might be evolving now that are embodied in your teaching? And maybe are there some questions that you're asking that might be the seeds, the grains of sand that will bring forth new pearls in terms of the further evolution of spiritual, of the spiritual path and spiritual practice?
Yeah, in my experience, the spiritual path is always evolving and developing, and that's a part of the meaning of responsiveness. Responsive meaning is always unfolding and bringing out new things, new, like, reality is always revealing further of its secrets, maybe some secrets that it never revealed before, because the situation never required them. So we have now situations, and our spiritual nature will respond to it, with whatever, you know, it got an infinity of possibilities and qualities and capacities that can come to the fore. And I know there are many people coming out with all kinds of interesting capacities and ideas and ways of action that are happening. And that does impact also spiritual practice itself. And that's why I myself prefer, for some reason, chosen an inquiry over any of the traditional methods, because inquiry is not a matter of trying to correct the situation or try to take oneself from one place to another. It is a matter of understanding the situation as it is, the totality of the situation, and seeing if it becomes liberated, how does it express itself? So it is a dynamic process, and it can be done in dyad, as I said, in groups, and it can might be able to do it in a bigger group too. So inquiry is, I'm developing other kind of practices that are more appropriate for our times. But inquiry, I think, is one powerful one, because it is really a matter of understanding what is happening, and part of understanding what's happening, understanding myself and what I can do about it. So that's, there's no end to it. There's no limit to where it can go or what situation it deals with. Like, the inquiry can be inquiry into my personal experience, can be inquiry about my relationship with my wife or friend, can be an inquiry into my living situation, can be my inquiry into the economic situation of the world, can be inquiry into the political situation, can be an inquiry into what is happening in this Arab Spring. Is it really what it's supposed to be, or what's going on to it, and what can be done about it? So inquiry can be applied in any field. And I'm teaching basically the principle of inquiry, how to make inquiry really effective, how to use true nature, spiritual nature, with all its intelligence and power and compassion for the service of inquiry as an exploration.
Now, this begs a question, in a way, about something maybe universal and essential about the whole matter of inquiry itself. Let me offer myself to you and, you know, just be transparent. You know, my practice very often is an inquiry, and that inquiry is one of trusting that that I am an awakening soul, that there is new awareness that will arrive for me, that just as I have grown, I will grow, and to press into that which is before me that seems to need more clarity or need a fuller response, and with the expectancy that new awareness will arrive. And so the tensions that appear in my world and in my experience that are that are incomplete. For instance, questions like, how can I serve more effectively, or how can we break the certain strangleholds socially that seem to have us in an impasse and an inability to grow or to change socially or politically. These kinds of big issues or very personal issues. Why are certain of my personal qualities getting in the way of certain relationships? You know, any question, I just hold that question with a kind of seriousness and a humility and a recognition that there is a deeper clarity that's possible. And almost from the heart more than from the head, I press into that with a kind of faith that new understanding can arrive. Is that what you mean by this practice of inquiry? And what would you add to what I've just said?
There's always a new understanding that can arise. Understanding is never ending in the sense it can magnify and optimize itself and see possibilities that we never seen before about what is happening in the situation, what can happen, what are the capacities that are possible, you know, what is the intelligence that is needed, what is the knowledge that is needed. True nature, spiritual nature, is an absolutely infinite, magical, and generous at the same time, and constantly wanting to serve. And serve because it loves everything it perceives to death. And, you know, when we are really realized, we are conduits for that. As individuals, we become conduit for this beautiful mystery that has no end to its possibilities and capacities. We'll never reach the end of it. So as our world expands and develops, and through nature will manifest different ways of experiencing and knowing and different actually practices and methods. I see the whole thing as a very endless kind of creativity that is both wonderful for the person who is engaged in it, because it is an aliveness through life, but it is also an expression of love and service and caring for life and other human beings.
Beautiful.
And the two things are not separate. My joy and the joy of seeing other people happy are the same thing.
Yes. Well, there's just one more question I want to put to you before we have our break and turn to the questions of the folks who've been listening.
Yeah.
And that is this. I know that when I created this series, I hoped to bring in people who were original thinkers like yourself, and also people from many of the existing great traditions of world spirituality. And it was a dilemma for me, and I've seen this be a dilemma for many people practicing interreligious dialogue or spiritual world spirituality in one form or another, to try to bring together representatives of all the traditions. There tends to be an underrepresentation of Islam, one of the biggest spiritual traditions in the world. And since you grew up originally in Kuwait, and you began your life as a Muslim, even though your path is really a kind of a transrational, trans path, you know, I think there's a question in the minds of many Westerners, like, is there a deep and profound spirituality that can come to us from the Islamic world? Is there a profundity that we can join with? We feel unmet there. We don't want to, you know, we have a liberal attitude that we ought to respect that tradition as fully as any other, and yet there's been less energy exchanged, you know, in that interface than in most of the others. And maybe you can shine some light on that for us.
Well, I mean, I experienced the same thing. I think what's happening is the spiritual side or expression of Islam is more the Sufi teaching. Sufi teaching and some of the Shiites, Illuminist schools. And they are, they have, I think, so far we don't see many of their representatives in the West the way we did in the past. And I don't really know the reason why. Many, part of the reason that many of them were being suppressed and persecuted in the various countries, the various dictators and movements, and the fundamentalist movement that is a big part of the Muslim world, makes it difficult for those people to come out. And so I will say there's less of them, and the ones who are there are not easy for them to come out. It's dangerous in those areas. But also, I don't see many of them in the United States and Europe as much as we were. Our era, you see, is in the last two decades. The main forms of spirituality that are dominant in the West that are not simply usual, you know, religion, like just religious Christianity or religious Judaism, whatever, are mainly the Tibetan Buddhism and Vedanta. These are the ones that are most dominant because they're the ones who have representatives, who have some realization. Many of the other ones, even Zen, for instance, or the Taoism, or the Sufi, you know, teachings, or the Kabbalah, they don't have that many living representatives that are operating in the West that are of the caliber to participate in what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's just that's what's happening now. I don't really know. I don't even profess to know what's exactly happening in the Middle East, although I grew up there. It's a different world than I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what's really happening or why it's really happening, you know, without living in it. So, yes, I mean, Islam has its spiritual side. It's very powerful. It has been for thousands of years as it waxes and wanes in terms of its influence and its visibility. These days, it's more waning than waxing, from what I see. Although there are some areas, for instance, there's some openness to some Sufi teaching. Like, you know, when I was in the Middle East this last May, for instance, I noticed some of the satellite channels were Sufi channels, which I was surprised, that really, Sufi channels, that was never heard of before. But at the same time, when I watched it, it is really watered-down kind of thing, the people dancing and singing, you know, religious songs. I don't know how serious it is, of a Sufi teaching it is, whether it is really the profundity of the Sufi teaching or some people who are interested in it some, and so I don't know. I'm really not that knowledgeable about that side, except to say that Islam does have its powerful mystical side. It has existed for thousands of years.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think it's good for us all to hear that. Well, I have more questions, but I know that a lot of other folks do too, and so I will take this moment to create a break. If you have a question for Hamid or for me, please just go ahead, and as many of you already have, and send us your question by typing it into that instant message window on your computer. But if you've dialed in by telephone, now, even if you have, there's one person who raised their hand already, please go ahead and raise your hand again, even if you've raised your hand already, and let us know that you have a question. Now, I want to make sure that if you are interested, you know how to find out more about Hamid's work. You can go to Ridwan.org, RIDHWAN.org, to find out about his school, or you can go to his website, which is ahalmas.com. And by the way, just to make it clear to everyone, Hamid Ali is his name, but he writes under the pen name A.H. Almas, which means diamonds, in the spirit that these are diamonds, maybe the diamonds on the soles of our shoes, the diamonds that are already here for us. We already have, but haven't always recognized and realized. So that's A.H. Almas or Ridwan.org. I also want to make sure that you're aware of my online course in integral spiritual practice. I've been helping people make a crucial transition from being a seeker to being a practitioner. And many people have made such a transition and become practitioners of a path or another, but discovered later that the particular kind of practice they were doing didn't address some other aspect of life, and then had to begin again. And so many of us, over a period of years and years and even decades of practice, have moved from path to path. A truly integral approach, one that is really able to be both heartfelt and intelligent, one that engages the body and the emotions and the mind and the spirit in a really interconnected way, is really what's necessary, a truly integral practice. And I'm so gratified to have been able to distill the essences of that into an 8-session online course that actually takes people step by step to a doable practice that really can take you from being a seeker to a practitioner, an integral practitioner, and therefore a person who can be a trustable participant in a new kind of culture. So all of this is available at theispcommunity.com. We're going through a process right now where we're rearranging this course. We're going to kind of relaunch it next month, and I hope many of you will consider taking it. It's you can look at the old write-up about it at theispcommunity.com right now. Also, please stay on the line, and at the end of this call, before we all open the lines and hear each other's voices and say goodbye, I'll tell you a little more about some of our upcoming guests. Dwayne Elgin will be with me in 2 weeks, the founder of Voluntary Simplicity and one of the original integral theorists, a really brilliant, wonderful human being and teacher. And Daniel Siegel, the neuropsychiatrist who has the author of The Mindful Brain, will be with me. Also, Bruce Lipton, evolutionary biologist. So I'll tell you more about those at the end of our call. All right. Let's see who we have with questions. Oh, well, here's one that's quite, I think many people will want to hear this. Deborah in San Rafael asks, among the various typological models, how and why did you choose the Enneagram as a vehicle and lens for psycho-spiritual development?
I actually do not use the Enneagram much as the vehicle. It is one of the things I use. Enneagram is one of the things I've learned earlier on in my spiritual practice, so I integrate it in my work. But I use many kinds of psychologies. You know, I use, psychoanalytic psychology, I use object relation, I use self-psychology, I use intersubjective psychology, I use, in attachment theory, all the psychologies, and I use some of the ancient ones, like the Sufi and the Buddhist psychologies. And so one of the psychologies I use are the Enneagram, and which is, I find, very useful, especially for learning about the manifestations of the ego. It's a very good, useful, effective tool for you for understanding the manifestation of the ego self. But I wouldn't think of the Enneagram as a central part in my work. It is just one of the things.
We have, thank you so much. We have a lot of questions that have been typed in on the the instant teleseminar window, not quite so many people have raised their hands for live questions. I want to encourage people, please do that. Here's a question from Argentina, from Buenos Aires. Tati says, Ken Wilber says in Integral Spirituality, Hamid is the finest metapsychologist writing today. I'm a big fan and love his work. But it could be improved so easily by a finer awareness of postmodern currents, the remnants of his reliance on archetypes, metaphysics, essence, aspects, and Husserlian phenomenology, all of which are monological and laced with the myth of the given, even if it is a transpersonal given, could easily be jettisoned without affecting his work in the least. I think maybe that was from Ken, I'm not sure. As someone that feels so grateful because of the work of both of you and that has followed your work as closely as I'm able to do, I'd love to hear you explore about what Ken is pointing to here. Thank you so much, Hamid. You, Terry, and Hamid are, for me, within the more trustable people in this world, with love, Tati.
Yeah, I like Ken. We have some kind of connection. Well, the whole thing about postmodern philosophy, I don't participate myself in postmodern philosophy. I'm thinking of actually writing a critique of it. I don't adhere to its finding. And the other thing is, most modern philosophy is only one kind of philosophy that is happening in the contemporary world. And basically, most modern philosophy, a large part of it, basically takes the notion of truth and throws it out. And for me, truth is central for spiritual realization, to find out what is true. What is true does not mean pre-given. Many people take truth to mean pre-given. There's nothing pre-given in spirituality, and the way I'm talking about it, that realization is the dynamic, that spiritual nature is the dynamic of truth that is always manifesting itself in various ways, and various, you know, novel ways, shows that even though there are things that are known, that we can actually have practices to realize a pure awareness or pure emptiness or pure love, that doesn't mean that these things are sitting there for us to discover them. It is a matter of us learning how to open ourselves in such a way so when the time is appropriate, true nature will manifest those qualities. But true nature or spiritual nature has many other things that are not yet discovered. But the thing that postmodern philosophy is something I don't agree with. It makes the human mind be more powerful than spiritual nature. It believes the individual or the culture is more determinant of reality than the spiritual ground, the spiritual nature. And that part I don't agree. I think it's simply not true in mystical experience. Anybody who really, truly has a mystical experience and realization realizes that all the mind, with all of its culture, with all it has learned, with all of its history, is out of the window at the time of realization, because realization is moving to realms that has nothing to do with those influences. In fact, that is the exact meaning of liberation, that we are free from these things. However, although we are free from these things, that freedom gives us the capacity to respond to the particular situation. And usually the response is not always the classic, the usual way from the past. It could be a novel way, a way that never happened before. So, you know, I'm just saying a few things to answer that question. It's a longer conversation, as I said. And
no, that's very rich. I appreciate what you're saying. There's a...
Some of the thing in postmodern philosophy is really good. I like a deconstructionist way of looking at things, deconstructing everything. But the thing is that spiritual practices in general are deconstructions, are mostly deconstruction. But when we deconstruct, we do find truths. We find we have insight and we discover realities that the mind, human mind, cannot come up with, regardless of our culture. Like the kind of experiences I've discovered myself in the Diamond Approach has nothing to do with my culture, my upbringing. I never heard about them, never been influenced about them. When I first started experiencing, I was looking for teachings or places where they talk about something similar. And it was difficult to find it. I'm still finding it difficult because true nature is manifesting something that is appropriate to the situation. So that's something I can say about it. But as I said, it's a long conversation, and we have to deal with more specific questions about postmodern philosophy and spirituality.
Yeah. Well, beautiful. I do have a side of me that's tempted to engage you in that theoretical conversation more, but I see a couple of questions about what I sometimes call shadow work, the psychological work that really changes the emotional patterns that tend to bind people's attention. And I know in my work, because we do teach shadow, people often want to know, well, how do I do shadow work on my own without going into therapy? Just working, you know, on my own, can you give me directions on how to do shadow work myself? And there are two questions that people typed into the instant teleseminar window. One of them, Kathy from Asheville, asked, what is your suggested skillful means to get out of a psychological loop that, of course, is hooked into core issues? We can look at it and feel it and journal it and discuss it because, of course, we are evolutionaries, but the personal stuckness is often still there. So one of my favorite quotes is, it's easy to be the Buddha when there are no bumps in the road. And then a fellow from Amsterdam, I think it's a man, Dale, says, well, should a person with a failing thyroid that's overproducing as a result of a bipolar condition attempt to realize the freedom beyond the structures of their personality? Those are very different questions, but I hope those help frame something about, like,
I think, first of all, if we have a problem with our thyroid, we need to deal with our thyroid because that's part of the vehicle through which we express our realization and through which we practice inquiry or any practices. So it's good to have our body be as healthy and sound as possible with whatever means we have. Spiritual realization is not going to solve these things. That's one thing. And the other thing about the shadow, how to deal with the shadow by yourself, it's difficult to deal with your own shadow by yourself. So you do need some help from somebody, therapist, or with friends. I mean, the way we do it in our school is that we work in groups. People give each other feedback. They confront each other. They see the shadow of each other and bring it up. And it is not an easy work. It's continual because some of the shadow of some individuals is pretty hidden. It doesn't come out until after years of knowing them. So to know one's own shadow by oneself, it's possible. It's not easy. And I will say, if there's any possibility for it by ourselves, is to cleave to the presence of true nature. True nature itself, the spiritual nature, is the liberator. If we can stay in touch with that and continue being in touch with that and be devoted to it and revere it as a true reality, it will bring up both the possibilities of how to deal with our shadows. It might reveal our shadows, challenges our shadows, or show us areas or people who can help us with it. But dealing with the shadow by oneself is definitely not an easy thing. By the mere definition of what the shadow is, see, something we don't want to know.
Right. Well, here's a question that kind of edges on to what you got to with that answer that I'd like to bring up. Well, first of all, I'd like to remind people, press star 2 if you'd like to raise your hand for a live question. And Judy Locke in Rochester, perhaps Rochester, New York, I think, maybe Minnesota, asks, how do we know that reality is revealing something or whether we are simply trying to make up an answer? Can you please give an example of how authentic revelation can be detected and identified and then lived out.
It is a process, and it's true. It's not always easy. First of all, there are capacities that develop in spiritual practice where there's a discernment. There is part of the capacity that develops is being able to tell what is true, what is not true. And that's not easy for most people. It has to do with realizing spiritual nature in a particular way that I call it the quality of truth. The true nature can manifest itself as simply truth. Truth that is not about anything, but will reveal the truth of things. And there's a capacity of discernment, discriminating awareness and knowing. So there are many capacities that are necessary for that, but the spiritual experience also has its own qualities that are very different from the individual or ego experience, in the sense that we are experiencing pure awareness, pure presence, and which is a completely different category of experience than thoughts, emotions, feelings, sensations, because it's a different mode of being. It's a pure consciousness. And that's how we know we are experiencing true nature, because we're experiencing what we consider purity, and we recognize it, that it is pure. And that doesn't mean there is no impurities in our consciousness, in our mind, but the true nature itself is pure. So that is one thing that many people maybe don't know. They believe that if you experience the purity, everything is pure at the moment. No. True nature or spiritual nature is pure. The vehicle itself might still have impurities. And true nature purities is in time. If given time and opportunity, it will expose those impurities and transform them. By impurities, I mean delusions and illusions and belief and psychological patterns and all kind of thing. So the other question of how to get out of psychological pattern, well, of course, part of it is understanding the psychological pattern. That's something that many people do. But there is no surer way than through nature itself, the actual presence of the spirit, the actual pure consciousness and awareness. And that is one thing that I have a problem with the postmodern people. They try to deconstruct without standing on that solid ground of true nature. You cannot deconstruct by being in your mind, in your thoughts. Thought cannot deconstruct itself. True nature deconstructs thought, you see. And true nature is something mysterious that thought cannot know, conceptualize, and can only know a little something about as it reveals itself, but something much more mysterious, much more powerful. And that is something that's very important to really know about the, why I tend not to, you know, care much about what the postmodern philosophers talk about, because most of them are not standing on the ground of realization and true nature. They are intelligent people, they have good information, and they're thinking intelligently. That's not enough when it comes to enlightenment and realization. Realization takes all those, throw them out, and brings out something completely different and new. It has nothing to do with these things. And it is also the question of how to be free from psychological, you know, loops, is by recognizing what we are, the purity of our true nature, the perfection of our spirit, which is the true hope for humanity, the true hope for us individually, and the true hope for our race and for life in general. And that's why I myself, when I see all the trouble going around, I'm not as disturbed as many people. I'm disturbed, I care. But I know there is at the core, at the depth of everything, there is this pure, perfect goodness whose functioning is to bring about goodness. And it is that, and my trust in that makes me feel that thing will work out one way or another. We'll work it out. I don't know how. Maybe it will take a long time, but will work out.
Mm.
We have that because that protects itself. True nature protects itself. It might be in a different life form. Maybe the human race as a whole will cease, but there will be other beings who will express enlightenment. Enlightenment and life is its own power, its own truth. It's beyond time and space and beyond the particulars of our present situation. It will continue to be and to know itself whichever way it's going to be. Hopefully it is in our earth and in our society and in our condition, but might not be. I don't really know. But I have trust that it will. And I recognize myself that I am that through nature and that everybody is. And that is really our true hope.
Beautiful. There were a number of questions about true nature, and I think you've probably answered them very richly. That was beautiful. There's a couple of questions about Idris Shah. One of them comes from someone named Ishu from Pune, India, asking, in one of the many interviews which you've given in the past, I remember you're talking about Idris Shah, pardon me, and his work, particularly through books, and how much you appreciate his work. My question is, have you known him personally, as I myself suppose? And if yes, how much and how deeply did he influence the developments of your personal inquiry into spirituality?
I did not know him. I never met him personally. I never met him personally. I've studied his work, and I know of him more through more distant contact and through his work and communications. And I sort of had a feeling of how he works, how he does his work, which I appreciated through his stories and his books. He has, if you read his books and his stories, he has a style, a way that I recognize as the manifestation of spiritual intelligence, because it has a precision and a beauty to it that is difficult to really to do, most people to do. He says things in his stories, the Sufi story. He brings all these Sufi stories from all ancient times, and he writes them in a style and in English that is really just wonderful and communicates some eternal truth in a very simple way. So I appreciated that. And of course, he does his work in a certain way. I'm not saying he's perfect or, he had a contribution to make, and he did it. And I appreciate that contribution.
Well, that's beautiful. There are so many questions. This is very funny. Often the people raise their hand by pressing *2, and they type in questions. For this particular conversation, we have quite a few people on the line, and almost all of them are typing in questions. So I'm going to stick with that for now.
We're not going to have time to answer all of
them. No, we really only probably have time for perhaps one more.
But we don't have the time. Yeah.
No, that's right. We don't.
There are, I'm sure, all interesting questions so far from what I hear.
Yeah, I think that people are asking questions from a very deep place and a very sincere place. Maybe this one from Heather in Vancouver, Washington, would be a lovely one to finish with. She asks, is there a basic inquiry question that one can use at the beginning of each day as a pathway or as a daily practice to grounding or centering or just being in present in a moment-by-moment way?
Yeah, where am I?
Where am I?
Meaning not geographically. Where am I in all dimensions? How I feel, what's going on with me, what am I thinking, what's happening with me? Where am I in the experiential universe? To find exactly where I am, because most of us don't really know where we are. We have ideas about it, reactions to it, but what is actually happening to us in the moment? It is a good place to start, because that's where the now is.
That's a beautiful practice. I sometimes suggest that people take a moment before they get out of bed and do some deep breathing and open their heart and connect to their heart and then ask an inquiry question, and this would be a rich inquiry question to use.
Yeah, like the Vedanta has the question, who am I, for instance, which is a good question too. Who am I? I find the question, where am I, is more approachable, because we're always someplace.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there's always something going on, you know. So we just find wherever it is, where we are. And if we really understand it, it will begin to open up and unfold and reveals more of what we are, what reality is.
Yeah. There are so many rich inquiry questions. I remember working with Who Am I? And my teacher, Adi Da, had a question, avoiding relationship,
mm-hmm.
which I used for years. And then I began using What Am I? And that opened things up differently.
That's a good question, too. Right?
And then I remember the teacher, Lee Loswick, who just died earlier, I think at the end of last year or the beginning of this year.
Oh, yeah, I hear that, yeah.
Yeah, he had a wonderful inquiry question. Who do I think I'm kidding?
Mm-hmm.
which I always love the humor of that inquiry. But where am I is very, very profound, I think, and very direct. Thank you so much for focusing us on that.
You're welcome. Good question, I think.
One last question. Could we have the fellow named Lawrence from Vancouver?
Yep.
Asks what's obviously a passionate and heartfelt question, very practical one. He said, lately I've been reflecting on the gap between my consumptive behavior and my ideology. I speak or think or blog or text or tweet about the evils of global warming and the importance of putting an end to the Keystone Pipeline. Yet I have more possessions than any king in pre-modern times would ever dream of having. And I'm even in the middle of renovating an old house in Cambridge using the finest materials. Ideology is one thing. Actually doing something is totally different. Reducing my footprint sounds like a nice idea, but let's face it, in terms of carbon footprint, I probably land in the top one percentile in the USA. Okay, I don't drive a Hummer, so maybe top 5%. I ask myself to practice wise reflection and self-compassion instead of feeling guilty and berating myself. Have you had similar thoughts or feelings? I'd love to hear what you have to say about this.
I think that the response to all of these things is sincerity. To be sincere with oneself. Because that will help us recognize all of these things, what's happening, why are we doing this, why are we doing that. Sincerity will bring in the humility, will bring in the truth, will bring in what's possible. We need to learn to be sincere with ourselves, truthful with where we are.
And that simply being sincere and truthful, this kind of back and forth of Lawrence holding ideals that he of sustainability that he knows he doesn't live. How can you maybe be more specific about that sincerity?
Like he's already being sincere by recognizing that he doesn't live it, right?
Right.
He has an ideology he isn't living. That's the beginning of sincerity. The next level of sincerity, what makes him not live it? Why not? What's behind that? That's another level of sincerity that's going to be more difficult to find. Because that will bring in question priorities and conscious influences and stuff like that. And that's where we become more and more sincere. So
beautiful.
I'm just a short answer since we don't have much time, really.
No, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you taking all this time with me and with everyone on the line. I mean,
I'm
been
glad
rich
to
spend this.
To do it.
Yeah, it's been lovely. Well, before I let everyone know what's coming up in a couple of weeks and before we open up the lines to say goodbye, a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series by going to beyondawakeningseries.com. And please also consider supporting my work and enriching your life by taking my course in integral spiritual practice at theispcommunity.com. To learn more about my other work and see videos, audios, and other writings, you can visit my own site, integralspiritualpractice.com. If you want to find out more about Hamid's work. You can go to his personal website at ahalmas.com or ridhwan.org. In 2 weeks, on October 2nd, I'll be speaking with Dwayne Elgin at 10 a.m. Pacific on Collective Crisis Meets Collective Wisdom. I'm very excited. This will be a rich conversation. Dwayne has been distilling the essential archetypal stories that we tend to live out consciously and unconsciously, and he's helped to deconstruct those and really has an awful lot of rich wisdom to offer along those lines. He's the original author of the book Voluntary Simplicity and really one of the original evolutionary thinkers and integral thinkers. On October 16th, I will have the opportunity to be in conversation with Dr. Daniel Siegel, author of The Mindful Brain, on the topic, The Changing Human Story, Consciousness, Cultural Evolution, and the Expanded Self. And I'm very excited. He's a wonderful teacher and thinker, and we should have a rich conversation. On Thursday, not our usual Sunday morning time, in the 5:30 p.m. Pacific time, a bit more convenient for our friends in Australia than those in Europe. I'll be speaking with Bruce Lipton, the author of Spontaneous Evolution, at 5:30 p.m. And please stay tuned. There'll be other remarkable conversations coming up. I think Joanna Macy will be joining me and others. So thanks so much for joining us. Let's open up our phone lines and goodbye, everyone.
I love you.
Hello.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hamid.
Thank you, Hamid.